Michael grew up in Doraville when it was just a country in the city. Way back in the 70s. And he remarked that there weren't many people here tonight. And I guess that means he won't be giving his talk on humility. This is a tough crowd, Michael. I'm trying to warm them up for you, but... Michael's been a good friend to me over the years. He's taught me a lot about friendship and loyalty, and I really respect him for that. And I've spent a lot of time on the phone trying to talk him out of doing stupid shit. With that, I give you Michael.
Now that y'all know everything, I can just sit back down. I'm Michael Hart. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. Hi, everybody. And to let you know that Tom did talk me out of doing a lot of stupid shit. You know, throughout the years, it's pretty neat. What happens when you gain friends in this program and you bond with them, God uses them. And there was a couple of times when I was getting ready to go do something stupid. And I was mad and furious, and there was only one train of thought. And Tom would call me. Or my stepfather would call me. Because like he said, I grew up in Doraville, and in Doraville in the 70s, you only had one thought of mine. You know, the guys I grew up with, we would get a case of beer, and we would run out of beer, and we'd fight each other. And the next night, we'd get a case of beer, and we'd run out of beer, and we'd fight each other. And it wasn't until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I realized that that wasn't normal. You know, first of all, I want to say thank y'all for asking me to do this. It's an honor. It's a privilege. And I will practice some humility tonight because I get to come up here and do this. You know, I get to share my experience, strength, and hope. I get to share with y'all what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. Because rightly so, I shouldn't be here. I was born in the doctor's hospital in Tucker, which is no longer there, so that kind of tells you my age right there. My family was from Scottsdale, Georgia. My grandmother's people was the Bruces. If you know anything about the Bruces, they were Scottish. We was poor, and we didn't know we was poor. We had everything we needed. My granddad and my real dad worked at the Scottsdale Mill, and they worked hard. My grandmother had the disease, or skin disease, that went throughout the Bruces, throughout our ancestors. If you don't know the Bruces, I'll give you a little bit of history. The Bruces was in the movie Braveheart. They were the family that portrayed William Wallace. And the father had that skin disease then. And my grandmother would drink from her bedroom. She wouldn't leave her bedroom. And she was alcoholic. And she would drink and stay drunk from her bed. And she was a mean woman. She abused my mother. I watched it. And the woman died drunk. So I was taught early about alcoholism, and I would tell myself I'm not going to be like that. My real father that worked at the Scottsdale Mill, the only thing I can really remember of him was rage and him being drunk. I always had a problem with being curious. My mother and my father lived on Lawrenceville Highway, and I was 4 years old, and I got out and left. And some teenage boys found me and took me across the street to a stop and go to a policeman, and they put me in DFACS. And it took my mother 8 weeks to get me back until the day she died. I never got to forget that because she would remind me of it. But while I was in that DFACS, the foster home, they gave us toys and stuff. So I'm going to go jump ahead and jump back. And that moment, I learned as I got sober how to give back. Since I've been in sobriety off and on, I will get the clubhouses to collect toys, and I give toys to the foster home every year. And it's because of what I went through then is why I try to give back to the foster homes. Give last year as an example, City of Refuge is here in Atlanta. It's a foster home. It's mainly for women for trafficking, but last year they had 167 children. And the clubhouses I go to, we made sure that those children had Christmas last year. So I learned to give back because of that one incident that I went through. When my mother got me back, her and my father was no longer together. And I always thought it was my fault. I was never told any different. Pretty neat thing about telling your story is you find out when you go back, usually the first 2 decades of your life is really what molds you as a man. Things that happens in those 2 decades is why we behave and act the way we do as we get older. And so, you know, for the women in the room, men, we have a childish side and we have a man's side. And every man in here, despite if you want to admit it or not, you've got a childish side, because every one of us do. And, you know, I have that side. A lot of times when I don't get my way about something, I beat on my high chair. but anyway, my mother married my second father, my stepfather, and he played a big role in my life. My stepfather was from Shenandoah Valley, Blue Ridge Mountains, West Virginia, Bluefield, Virginia, bordered West Virginia and Virginia. So a hillbilly raised me, and that's just the way it is. I got raised by a hillbilly, and I'm okay with that today. I used to be shameful of that. But he was a baby of 14, and on Friday nights, him and some guys would get together, and they'd play the guitar and sing, and he sounded better than Waylon Jennings. And I guess I was about 7, 8 years old, and I had my first drink of alcohol. It was Pabst Blue Ribbon beer, and it was awful. Yeah, I mean, it tasted nasty. But he would get drunk, and he would tear up the house. He would shoot up the house, and he was a Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde. And on Monday, he was back to work. He worked from 7 in the morning till 5 at night. He was a painting contractor, and he was a hard worker. I learned a lot from that man. Early on, when I came into the program, I put conditions on my sobriety, and one of the conditions was the death of my parents. Well, that man passed away in 2000, January 3rd of 2000, and him and I had no animosity toward each other. Actually, he showed me how to live, and the man also showed me how to die. He died with lung cancer. And the last thing come out of his mouth was something funny. And he was one of the funniest people I've ever met. but he raised me. I've got an older sister from my mom's first marriage. And in my early years, my mom would get me and my sister ready, and my aunt would call and say, "Don't bring the kids. Pete, that was my real dad, he's drunk." And I can remember my sister saying that our dad cared more about the bottle than he did us. And February 1st of, I was 10 years old. Actually, I'll back up, 28th of that year, my real dad had a stroke, and they buried him on my birthday. So I've never been one to celebrate birthdays. I just don't really care for birthdays. It was a hard thing for a 10-year-old boy to go through. To this day and time, I realize it's pretty hard. I used to really stuff it and not pay attention to it. so, you know, back to the stepfather, he pretty much taught me how to be a man. And like Tom mentioned, I grew up in Doraville. We moved to Doraville, and the boys there we were just mean. All of us, we were just mean. As a young boy, we played war with pine cones, green pine cones. And it was actually fun, you know. The boy grew up across the street from me. He was just as mean as me and my brother was. when my brother was 9 years old, I was 13. My stepfather tried to kill his brother with the claws of a hammer. My brother witnessed it. So that was the type of man I grew up with as a father. During dinner, you didn't speak. You spoke when you were spoken to. And he had stopped drinking by then, and I didn't really realize what was going on, but he was a stark sober lunatic. And I knew nothing about that because he didn't use AA. At times, he'd take the back part of his hand, and I'd be on my shoulders from the dinner table, and I would not dare ask what I had did wrong. But I remember when I was 13, it was at night, I was looking out my back window and seeing flashlights jumping over the fence at the house, and DeKalb County had surrounded the house. Had a helicopter over the house, and they arrested him for taking claws to a hammer to his brother, and my brother witnessed it. And back then, things was a little different than it was now. DeKalb County even let my mother go back in the back and take a picture with him together, a mugshot. I still own that mugshot today. It's funny as shit. So, yeah. but we live in a different time now. You know, that ended up being a simple battery on him. But he was a pretty violent man back then. I thought when you worked on your car that your tools were supposed to end up over the house and in the woods. I mean, I just, that's what I thought. I didn't really realize what he was going through because he had stopped drinking on his own. And as I got into my teens, I would do, you know, I'd come home drunk and pick a fight with him, and we'd end up having Dorville called. When I was 13, I was also diagnosed with a crippling disease. I was really active in sports, and suddenly I couldn't play sports anymore. The disease is a form of rheumatoid arthritis. It forms in your spine. It fuses your spine to be one bone. And it's called ankylosing spondylitis. And they told me when I was 13 that if I didn't do what they asked me to do, that I was going to be in a wheelchair when I was 16. And back then, we didn't have any money, and we went to Grady Hospital. My mother got me a Grady card, and spent a lot of time at the Crippled Children Clinic, seeing a lot of sick kids. And I always had a gift of seeing other people with worse than I. And back then, the only thing they had for inflammation was aspirin. And at the Children's Crippled Clinic, I did a lot of physical therapy that was very intensively painful. And they had me on high doses of aspirin. They had me eventually, at the end there, I was on 5 aspirin in the morning, 5 aspirin at lunch, 5 at dinner, and 5 at bedtime. And by the time I was 14, it burned a hole in my stomach. So they put me on Maalox. So we'd get big boxes of aspirin, we'd get big boxes of Maalox. And I got used to doing this with the aspirin. And to cure the hole that they burnt in my stomach, I got used to doing this. And I was determined that I was not going to be in a wheelchair. Because see, early on, what I learned by having the stepfather I did and the father I did and growing up where I grew up at, I learned that I was a fighter. And I fight. My first thing when something goes wrong is I fight it. And I got living proof. I got a track record today that when I fight something, I get through it. I played varsity football when I was 15 and a half years old. I fought that disease and beat that disease. That disease told me that I didn't have a disease because I'd get better and I'd stop doing the physical therapy I was supposed to do and I'd stop taking the medicine and it would hit me overnight. And I'd be almost paralyzed again. And my spine would swell up and my knees would swell up. And so I knew when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and they said, this is a disease that tells you you ain't got one, I knew because I already went through something like that. I found out throughout my life that when I go through something, usually God puts me through it for a reason. I go through something to get me ready for something coming. So I'm not going to talk about war stories much. We all got them. You know, I just mentioned to you pretty much what happened when I started drinking and drugging. I pretty much never drank to socialize. You know, I surrounded myself with boys that I grew up with that drank like I did. You know, I started drinking when I was right before I was 16. I stopped when I was 23. And in those 8 years, I had 6 DUIs, 11 public drunks, 9 disorderlies, a hit and run, and surgery on my eyes. due to fights. So I earned my seat in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I get to come in here. My hit and run, I want to talk about that a second. The hit and run I had, I was leaving my apartment complex and I hit four cars. The Volvo, I hit it, rounded it off on each side. I was in a 71 Ford truck with a 302 in it. It was bad. It was a bad truck. And I was car climbing long before it was popular. And my best friend, after that happened, he'd say, "Hart, let's go car climbing." Because I climbed all over the top back of those cars. 10 people seen me do it. Had a helicopter after me, had the police after me on foot. I got away. I called that stepfather of mine, and I told him, I said, "I really messed up this time, and he's going to take up for me, say I was with him." And he always joked about it forever, because my family was one of my enablers. You know, we knew the mayor of Doraville, so I could do stuff and get away with it. So I always thought I was special. I always thought I deserved special treatment. But Pop said he's going to wait, but take up for me until he realized a bus full of nuns seen me do it. You know, and that was his way of laughing about, you know, making fun of me. And the thing is that the two individuals that was in my apartment that night waiting for me to go get more drugs and booze, they said they were too drunk and too messed up to go anywhere. And I was the reckless one. Both of those individuals are dead today, drug and alcohol related. Cindy Spradlin, she was in my apartment that night. She died of an overdose, swallowed her puke, and that killed her. And Shane Taft hit a pickup truck on his motorcycle, drunk. So those two individuals will always have a special place in my heart because I get to live today because of them, those two individuals. I grew up with some people that's not here today because of this disease. You know, so I get to come in here and share my experience, strength, and hope. I get to come to Alcoholics Anonymous and get better. That was early part of 87. I had got that truck fixed, went to court on it, had a guy sitting next to me in shackles and handcuffs. And they called out witnesses on me for a few minutes, and he leaned over to me and he said, "God, I'm glad I'm not you." Didn't even know what was happening. I was in so much denial about my addiction. I got that truck fixed, got a beautiful paint job on it. Hadn't had it back 10 days and slammed it into the guardrail at Shamley Tucker in 85 and totaled it, put the engine inside of the truck with me. So at the time I worked for Atlanta Journal-Constitution, so instead of stopping drinking, I thought it was better that I moved closer to work. That made sense, you know. So I moved closer to work and started riding a bicycle. And my last drink of alcohol and the last line of cocaine was Carlos McGee's on Shamley Tucker Road with a friend of mine named Jimmy Giles. And the next morning I rode my bicycle to work and my boss sent me home because I was late. And I was fearful of losing that job because I had never lost a job. I'd learned a lot of work ethics from my stepfather and I really liked working. And I was afraid I was going to lose everything I had in that apartment. Well, I rode that bicycle back home, and I was in that apartment, and I thought my life was over with. Little did I know it was just getting ready to begin. I felt like I was having a nervous breakdown. I thought everything around me was falling apart, and out loud I said, "If there is a God, please help me." About 10 minutes later, I dialed the information and got the number for Peachford. I called Peachford, and they told me to set still, that they'd have somebody out to me the next day. Well, I sat still the next day. They had the therapist come out to me, and I already changed my mind. But I went anyway. And that was the biggest step I've ever took in my life, was stepping across that threshold, leaving that apartment that day, and I went into treatment in Buford. And in treatment, that stepfather that had put down alcohol and my mother come into treatment, and they were sitting there and while I was in detox, and my stepfather said, "I'm sorry this is happening to you. I'm sorry you're having to go through this." Because see, my family thought I was supposed to just put it down, because my stepfather did, because everybody else in the family did. My brother wasn't one of us. My sister was a good shoe. She was the angel. Still today, she still is the angel. She's the only person I know that's ever had one job her whole life. Great work ethics. So I felt so shameful because I couldn't put down alcohol on my own. When I went back to my detox room that night, after my mother and father left, I destroyed the room. Destroyed the bed, everything in the room, tore the room apart. Just so upset at myself because I couldn't put alcohol down. Tore the lamp up in my room. They put another lamp in my room. After the third lamp, they quit putting lamps in my room. Because my first emotion that I felt when I came in Alcoholics Anonymous was anger. I was angry at me for what I was having to go through. And I didn't know what was happening. And I want to read something real quick that I found in the big book. And this is really pretty much the way my life's been in Alcoholics Anonymous. This is in the Kings of the Kingdom. It's on page 311. It says, AA is not a plan of recovery that can be finished and done with. It is a way of life. And the challenge contained in the principles is great enough to keep any human being striving for as long as he lives. We do not, cannot outgrow this plan. As arrest alcoholics, we must have a program for living with that allows for limitless expansion. Keeping one foot in front of the other is essential from attaining or arresting. Others may idle in a retrogressive groove without too much danger, but retrogression can spell death for us. However, this isn't as rough as it sounds. As we do become grateful for the necessity that makes us to toe the line, for we find that we are more than compensated for our constant efforts by the countless divine we receive. A complete change takes place in our approach to life. Where we used to run from our responsibilities, we find ourselves accepting it with gratitude that we can successfully shoulder it. Instead of wanting to escape some perplexed problem, we experience a thrill of challenge and the opportunity it affords for another application of AA's techniques, and we find ourselves tackling it with surprising vigor. That's pretty much been my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, like I said, when I got here, I thought my life was over with. Little did I know it was just beginning. My first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't go in a pizza joint. I didn't know pizza and beer didn't go together. I mean, it just didn't make sense to me. You know, and I subconsciously had shut out tomato juice. I was 10 years in the program and had a V8, and I said, damn, this is good. Because my last drink of choice was Bloody Mary's. And I just subconsciously shut it out. That first year in Alcoholics Anonymous, a man named Ron LaJoy became my sponsor. I met him over at Tucker. Tucker St. Andrews was my home group. And he said, I want to take you over to this other clubhouse with me, because I didn't have a driver's license. I rode a bicycle everywhere I went. So he would come get me. And he did a lot of service work over at the Biscayne Room. And he said, you're going to clean ashtrays. I said, I don't smoke. He said, I don't give a damn. And pissed me off. You know, he told me, you're going to stand at the front door and you're going to welcome people. And I said, what the hell's this got to do with staying sober? And he said, don't worry about it. But see, I had that gift of desperation. And I was willing to do anything because I didn't want to drink anymore. I really didn't want to. I wanted to be that strong individual that the rest of my family was. You know, I made a mistake by one day. I called him and I said, I'm bored. And he said, no, you're boring. Pissed me off. He said, get a damn hobby. And I didn't know what he was talking about. I had to look. He made me look the word up. You know, because the things that I thought was fun wasn't really fun. It was kind of warped. I mean, the guys I thought fighting was fun. I didn't know that wasn't something that you were supposed to do. So, end of my second year, I got a 65 Fastback Mustang. And I restored it. Little bit by little bit, lot by little bit. And all the bands that I went and seen blacked out, I went and seen them again sober. And amazing things, the next morning I had my concert t-shirts. I didn't lose them. The next morning I could remember that last song. And the pretty neat thing, you know, I grew up with Elvis Presley and George Jones and Tammy Wynette and Merle Haggard and Waylon Jennings. And there was a club over on Pleasantdale and Shamley Tucker. I had a lot of influence with RCA. I got to see Carl Perkins live. He was this close to me shuffling his feet playing Blue Suede Shoes. And many of y'all that know me, I've got an Elvis Presley room. You know, that implanted redneck syndrome has been hard to go away. You know. But the next weekend, Carl Perkins, where he showed up, 50,000 people was there. And I felt like God let me see that. You know, that was done for me. Well, into the second year of my program, that best friend of mine that I had, he was still using. He was still drinking. And I'd go out with him, and he knew I wasn't drinking anymore. Actually, he did things to try to get me to drink, and I wouldn't. He killed someone in another car. And I had been praying for God to bring him into the Perrooms, and it didn't happen the way I wanted it to. So I was pretty mad at God. The pretty neat thing that I've learned is I don't know what's right or wrong. I don't know what's good or bad. You know, it was the best thing that ever happened to him. You know, he served his time. He's got a 13-year-old boy today. He's in corporate now. But I was on that same path. I was on that same path. I knew that I was going to kill someone in another car. I don't know how many times I woke up and didn't know where my car was. Or I woke up on that cold floor in the holding tank with that pending doom of what that guard was going to tell me when he came to the door and what I did the night before. Or I woke up and I went to the mirrors and I seen my eyes black and not remembering being in a fight. You know, so I was on that same path. And the pretty neat thing, I was able to help Jimmy immediately for 6 months before he got sentenced. 15 years, I took him to a meeting every night in that 65 Fastback Mustang. Into my third year, I met my first wife. Met her at that club where I seen Carl Perkins. And I think the first 8 months, I didn't see anything but her legs. I got her pregnant, and my mother said I was supposed to marry her. And my best friend's dad said, "You're going to marry her." And so I married her. Worst thing I ever did. You know, but I was hard-headed. You know, I had to learn. I don't know about y'all, but I'm one of them alcoholics that I've got to learn things the hard way. I can listen to someone else, and I can listen to someone else's experience. But I've been one of them that I've just got to learn things the hard way. You know, I like on 116 where it says, you know, we're going to have a new attitude, and finally we brought as many us inner strength and peace that could not be deeply shaken by the shortcomings of others or by any calamity not of our own making. You know, I like that part, the calamity of our own making, because I've been through some adversities in sobriety and have not thought about a drink or drug walking through them. You know, I've got to design a living today. I've got principles that I get to live by. I guess about our third year's marriage, I had decided that I didn't want to be married anymore. And I'd ask her for a divorce, and she disappeared with my son. And it took me a year to find her to get my divorce. And after I got my divorce, she went back to the state of Florida where she went to and told a judge that she didn't know where the father of her baby was. And a year later, I had a DA in Clayton County calling me, and we'd been divorced. I'd been giving her child support. And he said I needed to come see him, and I said, "No, I don't." And he said, "Yes, you do." And I said, "Well, who are you?" And from that point, he commenced to show me who he was. While Spencer was in my custody, he came and locked me up. I was in Clayton County Jail for 30 days with no bond. At the time, Jerry Benefield was my sponsor, and Mary Benefield was the only one who could talk to me while I was in the holding tank, because Jerry talked so low, and Mary would talk to me. And I got to talk to my son while I was in there. My son was crying at the time. He was 6 years old, and he was saying, "Daddy, where are you? Daddy, why can't you come get me? Daddy, please come get me." And it just ripped my heart out. One of the worst things I've ever been through. And I went through it sober. Didn't think about a drink or a drug, but I damn well tell you I was very homicidal going through that. After I got out of jail, my mother looked at me in tears, and she said, "Why don't y'all let me kill her? My life's already over with." You know, and so it, you know, really ripped the family apart. And at that point, I remember having to take my son to the state line, Lake City, right on the other side of Valdosta there into Florida. And coming back to Georgia, it was the hardest thing coming back by myself every year when it was time to give him back to his mama. But what God was teaching me to do was God was teaching me how to let go of him. God was teaching me how to let go of him. I'm proudly to say today that my son's naval intelligence. He's served his country. He's been in for 5 years. And I've learned to let go of him. I'm proud to say that the abuse that I went through as a child, I broke that cycle. My son's never had me strike him. I'm proud to say that 25-year-old, actually he just turned 26, never seen his daddy drunk. You know, because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to break that cycle with him. Him and I are going through some things right now, but, you know, it'll be okay. Father and sons go through them, and I know it. What I've learned the hard way about everything that I put in front of my program, I'm going to lose it. It's just a known fact. But see, I got that egomaniac with inferior complex. You know, at times I say, I got this. I can do this. And I forget about how I got this. You know, I get to today live a life that I really should have never got. If I die tomorrow, I've got to live an incredible, fulfilled life. I've had some adversities and I've had some triumphs. I got some lovers and I got some haters. And I'm okay with both. You know, actually, my haters kind of makes me amuse. You know, I'm another one that, you know, I found out the hard way that I used to want, I take everything personal. I want you to like me even if I don't like you. Which don't make no damn sense. You know, I get to do what I love for a living. People ask me, what do you do? And I say, I get to play with cars. You know, I've been in the towing industry for a long time now. Tom McNally's been in it with me off and on. In 01, 02, and 03, my tow truck drivers were the most paid drivers at Atlanta Auto Auction. They were the best paid drivers. And there's not an exotic car that I haven't had in my possession. And you know, what a little boy's dream. You know, this past weekend, my days kind of blend together because I get to drive. Yesterday morning, matter of fact, I got to see incredible sunrise. I was headed to Hilton Head to swap out a Lexus. I put that job, I put that career in front of everything. My second wife was from a third world country. She was Latin. And for y'all men, everything you've been told about a Latin woman is true. Everything, including the temper. She'd get mad at me and get out and start walking, and I'd be begging her to get back in the car. Finally, I just left her where she was, and she quit doing it. But she is a good woman. Good, strong Catholic woman, and I messed that marriage up because I put everything else in front of that marriage. That towing business I had in 05, end of 05, a drunk driver hit one of my trucks and shut my business down. Amazing how things turn around. Amazing what happens. I deserved that. I don't know how many times I go drunk. I can't tell you how many things I hit. I don't know how many mailboxes I took out, you know. But what that did was put me on the radar with DOT, and there were some regulations that I wasn't aware of that I was supposed to be doing. And they came to my house and put my paperwork through a DOT audit and shut me down. At the time, I had 11 employees, and I had to downsize back to me and create another thing. Another thing that I learned by being sober is that the creativity that I have. I know how to create ways to create jobs and to make money. God's given me that gift, and I'm glad I have that. But that day when they put me through that DOT audit, the first DOT police officer pulled in my driveway, my anxiety went up a little bit. Second one pulled into the driveway, my anxiety went through the roof. But the pretty neat thing is I didn't have to go hide my dope. You know, a pretty neat thing. I didn't have to go. I didn't have any felonies on me. You know, I didn't have any warrants on me. I had insurance on everything that I have. And I pretty much had to bankrupt. You know, for us, sometimes defeat ain't we fight defeat. We fight it. And I bankrupt, give everything back but one tow truck. And I ran that tow truck by myself. Had got a divorce from that Latin wife I had, which I pretty much sabotaged it, because I'm a good boyfriend. I'm a really good a man, but I'm not no good as a husband. I'm just not. And I found that out through that marriage, because I hurt a lot of people. Well, the last woman after her, Gina Ford, we had got together and been together for a while. She helped me build my business back. And I started to do an impound lot in the city of Doraville. And I'll back up. My mama used to tell me, stay out of Doraville. Just don't come back to Doraville. Because that Doraville jail was my second home. Well, when I started to create that impound lot, the mayor and I became pretty good friends. And I went in front of city council and pitched that business in front of city council, and all six of the city council voted yes. And it was pretty neat that I spent majority of my childhood or my teen years in their jail, and here I was pitching a business in front of them. And Alcoholics Anonymous is who I give that credit to. Well, in 2011, before we got things off the ground, that mayor, he died February 16th. March 1st of 2011, Gina Ford was diagnosed with cancer, breast cancer. March 16th, she was diagnosed with bone cancer. In the first year of her having cancer, it was really, really hard on all of us. And I'm a fighter. I wanted her to fight it. You know, the first year she fought it, and I didn't realize what it was doing to me physically. I'd went to stroke level. I was had to go to the emergency room. And in the emergency room, they had put all that stuff on me. And my son looked at me in tears. It scared him. And he said, Daddy, I need you. I can't take care of Gina by myself. And I didn't realize what I'd been doing with my son, with caretaking and caregiving everybody around me. And I taught him to do the same thing. But at the same time, you know, if any of y'all got children, your children's watching. My son learned how to do service work. And the military at that time decided to put him overseas, and I didn't really realize how much he had helped me with Gina at that time. At that time, the chemo got worse. The Oxycontin got worse. They gave her for bone cancer, and at times Gina would be violent, and she would just go off on me. And I didn't know how to handle it. And we separated. And the letter she left me was, first of all, I want to say I love you, but my cancer's taken a toll on both of us. And it had. 10-11 months later, I do what a lot of men do, and I'm not proud of this. I'm ashamed of it. I band-aided it with another woman. And then August of 2014, she decided not to do treatment anymore, and I realized what that meant. At the same time, I seen my son trying to battle to get home. The military wouldn't let him come home because her and I was never married. And the woman I'd got with had asked me to marry her, and I said no. And I wouldn't commit. October 11th of 2014, Gina died. And, you know, I never once thought about a drink or drug, but what I learned from that is that I band-aid everything I go through when I'm not feeling right. I've got a hole inside of me, and I'm going to fill it up with something. And I usually fill it up with something that's not good, not something spiritual. At the same time that was going on, my son was doing service work over in Germany. And this, I'm so proud of this. He had went. He works naval intelligence, and he was working for a general, and he went in and told the general idea, and the general said, "Will you assemble it?" So he assembled 50 people. And they went 2 miles away from the base of the Battle of Bulge, and they cleaned the tombstones of the graveyard right before Veterans Day. And they do that every year now. They get in a bus and they follow my son to the graveyard. But he learned service work. You never know when you're learning service work who's watching you and who's going to be affected. And I'm so proud of him for that, because he started something over in Germany. And there's people's lives that I've never touched, or I've never seen that I've touched, because my son watched me do service work. Because what Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me to do when everything's falling apart around me is I get all in service work. And, you know, I've learned this past couple of years that I'm still selfish. I'm still self-centered. I make decisions on self that place me in a position to be hurt. And the last thing I did with a woman, was I realized I hurt a lot of people when I did that. The ripple effect of it was really tremendous. 2 years ago, I was in a lot of pain and needed to sit still. And Chris Corder helped me through it. He told me to come on over here to Fifth Tradition and just sit still. And I did. And what I did was I decided to sit still, and I started listening to Andy Stanley, and he has a CD about sex, relationships, and in that CD he says, you know, if you haven't learned from your past, it will become your present. And I heard that loud and clear, because I had kept doing the same things over and over, and it was becoming my present every time. I kept attracting the same woman with different face, different body, doing the same thing, because I had a dominating, controlling mother, and I would rebel every time in every relationship. So last 2 years ago, I decided to sit still, not get involved with anybody. It was the best thing I did. I learned a lot about myself. I learned that I've always wanted everybody to like me, when it really doesn't matter. I've learned that I, you know, I'm a people pleaser, and I really shouldn't be. And a couple of years ago, about a year and a half ago, I started reading this every morning. It says, no matter who you are, what you look like, or what you share with the world, there will always be someone doesn't approve of you. You are who you are, and you're enough. It isn't your job to conform to their idea of what constitutes a worthwhile human being. Instead of focusing on all the people who don't approve of you, try to take some time today to remind yourself of all the people who do approve of you and appreciate you and accept you. They're the people that matters the most, and the ones that you need to focus on. Let go of the rest. You know, that's something I practice every day now, because I'm also an Al-Anon. I'm a double winner. And I learned that from that mother of mine. She took care of everybody when there was nobody else to take care of. She laid down and died. And I'll back up a little bit. She passed away in 2009. And she called me as she was having her heart attack. Me begging her to dial 911, and she wouldn't. And her last words to me was, hush your mouth. And I still ain't learned to do it. You know, but that's okay today. You know, today I know that I'm a human being, and that I'm here trudging this road with everybody else. And I've got to live in recovery. You know, when I was married to that Ecuadorian woman, me and my son went over to Ecuador, and we climbed the highest active volcano in the world, and I got to do it with my son. We straddled the equator. You know, wow. The things that I've got to do, and I really shouldn't got to be here. You know, I read this every morning. It says, stop explaining myself. I stop explaining myself when I realize people only understand from their perception of me. And I got to remember, sometimes people don't really know the perception of me. I got to remember, sometimes people only know me through someone else's words of me. You know, and this is, I'm going to say this, and really this is very valuable for all of us. The 12th tradition is very valuable. Very valuable. What's said to me is supposed to stay with me. Period. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions. We're to practice a genuine humility. You know, what does that mean? That means every one of us is created equal. I'm just another drunk on the bus. I'm not supposed to gossip about you. Gossip is just poison. If I didn't see you do it, I don't know you did it. I don't know. I know you're an alcoholic the minute you walk in these doors. You know, I heard a man tell his story one time about the 12th tradition. He said the only time that he was supposed to look down on another drunk was when he was reaching down to help him up. And that's what I'm supposed to do with you as an alcoholic. I'm to share my experience, strength, and hope with you, not my opinion. My opinion don't matter. Jerry Benefield taught me a lot about the 12th tradition. He said you give a man back his family, his car, his house, you give it back to him too soon, it's like giving him a loaded gun. And I have let those blessings spoil me. I have put money, property, and prestige before my primary purpose. And every time, guys, I've lost it. But the pretty neat thing is that I know now, as a confident individual, that I can get it back because I have a track record. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. It's given me a track record. It's given me a track record of building good relationships with people. You know, I used to think, and I have a problem with this now, that when I forgive you, that meant I was supposed to let you back in my life. That does not what that means. You know, because another thing that I found out, my best friend's dad, when he was dying, I had just went through a nasty breakup, and I went over to his house, and I said, "Pop, I am so unmanageable." And he said, "No, Michael, no, you're not. You allow people in your life that makes your life unmanageable." And I found out then that I have a problem with boundaries. "Oh, you want to abuse me? Come on." You know. And I don't have to have that today. Setting healthy boundaries with people. Actually learning to say, "No, I don't want you in my life. You bring havoc." Because see, I didn't know I could do that. Me as an alcoholic with low self-esteem, I thought I was supposed to help. I was supposed to let you in my life. You know, and so being a healthier individual and making healthier choices today is healthier for me. I learned to love myself. I'm going to say this and be quiet. I'm not going to get on a soapbox because I can real easily do that. I am so filled with gratitude today because I get to live this program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I do look at the people in my life that does want me there. And I don't look at the ones that don't. And I look at the things that God has given me. You know, I've got a really good business today. I live in a $300,000 home that's almost paid for. I've got a son that's never seen me drunk, that's naval intelligence. I've got, my life is so full. And I wouldn't have any of it if it wasn't for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because rightly so, like the two individuals that died when I was going to get more booze, I should have been one of them. You know, and I'm not. Instead, I get to come in here and share with y'all what I've been through and the adversities in recovery that I've never even once thought about a drink or a drug. Now, have I thought about homicide? Yeah. You know, but have I thought about a drink or a drug or harming myself? No. You know, the pretty neat thing Tom touched on a while ago, and I'll leave with this. I'd be going to do some crazy stuff, and I think I shared this a while ago, and either Tom or my stepdad would call me. You know, that was God protecting me from me. And I find once God takes something out of my life, He's usually ready to put something better in my life. And when I see that and trust in God, amazing things happen. I'm just another human being in here, and if I can walk through the things that I've walked through and stay clean and sober, so can you. In the doctor's opinion, it says people that went in and out made many resolutions but never decisions. And I hope today that the people in the room that's new make a decision to stay clean and sober. I'll say this and be quiet. This has not been an easy way of living, but it sure in hell has been a better way. Thank you.